Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in Asian Studies, a podcast series on New Books Network. My name is Hui Ying, and I'm here as one of the hosts on the channel. Today, it is our great pleasure to welcome Dr. Zhang Meng here with her new book, Timber and Forestry in Qing China, that just came out in 2021 with University of Washington Press. Welcome, Dr. Meng.
Hi, Hui Ying. It's my great pleasure to be here. And I've been a listener to the New Books Network for a very long time. And it is certainly great to have this opportunity to bring my own book to this channel.
We have been waiting for this book for a long time. So before we jump into the specificity of the book, would you like to share a little bit more about yourself, your academic background, or anything you want to share with the audience here?
Sure. I grew up in a small city in northern China, and I went to Peking University for college, where I actually studied finance. So during that time, I did some very interesting research assistant work for a professor that is related to economic history. And at the time, I felt that, that's so interesting and definitely more work needs to be done that combines a good knowledge of economics and also a historian's ability to work with primary sources. So that's how I decided to pursue a PhD in history. And I went to UCLA for graduate school. So I still think that UCLA has a very great program for economic history because not only were there great economic historians who work on different world regions in the history department, but also we have good collaboration with economics and other social sciences on campus. But then, of course, after years of study, my own understanding of history as a discipline also evolved. It's no longer just the sort of naive understanding of an undergraduate. And I came to engage with other subfields such as environmental history and material culture and so forth. UCLA. I first worked at Loyola Marymount University for a few years, and then I jumped at the opportunity when Vanderbilt searched for an economic historian and came to my current position.
Yeah, congratulations on the new position. So you're talking about kind of your coming into current stage by bringing different fields of expertise, right? Finance, economic history, environmental history or Qing history, Chinese history, material culture, just to name a few. And specific to this book, why did you choose or how did you come to focus on the subject or the object of timber? What's special about timber?
Mm-hmm. So coming from economic history, my interest began with a question on how long-distance trade was conducted. So what kinds of formal and informal institutions worked to help the merchants solve some of the typical challenges, like contract enforcement, information asymmetry, and capital constraint, and to what extent these institutions were effective. So for that, there's a very rich literature on institutional economics and the economic history of long distance trade that I hope to engage with. But as I got more into the dissertation project, I tried to narrow it down to a specific trade and ended up with the trade of timber for a number of reasons. First, it really satisfies my search for a bulk, capital-intensive, large-scale, and long-distance trade that is not just luxurious and sporadic, right? And second, the trade of timber was not heavily regulated or subsidized during this period in Chinese history, unlike salt or grain, right? So those are the kind of bulk commodities under more direct state supervision in this time. So timber really could allow me to look directly at the private order institutions among the merchant groups that were it could be representative of other long distance trade at this time as well.
Yes, so thank you for explaining a little bit more how unique the trade of timber was compared to other kinds of commodities. So following this line, and what's special about this time period as you were talking about? So was the trade of timber as unique as this in prior times in China, or became less unique after the fall of the Qing? Or what's special about this particular time period?
Right. So the book focuses on the Qing period, so roughly from the 17th century to the very end of, well, to the beginning of the 20th century, really. So the Qing period is interesting and important in Chinese historiography for multiple reasons. But for me, like from a more broader comparative perspective, it provides a very interesting case because it is quite different from the very familiar narrative of the development of modern forestry. So rather than being just another case study that largely repeats the familiar narrative of, say, the rise of state-directed forest management and the later so-called scientific forestry, such as in early modern Europe, in Japan, in British India, Southeast Asia, and so forth, the Qing pattern really stands out from these other cases that the literature has already looked at, right? Its pattern of private initiatives for reforestation is something that we really haven't seen much in other regions in the early modern period. And for that, I think it is a very forceful rebuttal against his historical teleology, and it invites us to think about the multiple paths of historical possibilities. And with this project, I also came to realize the lack of scholarship that takes both the environmental and the economic seriously. So overall, I think that there's a tendency among environmental historians to take the economic transactions for granted, right? So trade is always to be blamed, and it is assumed to happen anyways. And there's also a tendency among pre-modern or early modern economic historians to take the resources for granted, right? We care more about, say, the rise of Industrial Revolution, but we don't care too much about where the fuel or the kind of resources come from. But I think really the two aspects have to be examined together because in the case of timber and forestry, the particular form of state regulation, the particular form of forestry, and the particular system of trade and distribution, these are all highly intertwined and interdependent. So in both economic history and environmental history, I'm hoping to see more work that recognize the concerns and the priorities of each other and bridge this discursive gap between the two. And that's what I hope to achieve in this book.
Definitely. I think that's one of the largest contribution of your book, and also one of the few or pioneering work that really engage these two thoughts or two perspectives together. And following what you are saying about the intertwined and interdependent trade of timber and timber as the resource, also talking about the Qing state particular form of involvement, which you kind of provided a close analysis throughout chapter one and two. The question is, as you pointed it out, if we see that the Qing imperial court's timber consumption had minimal impact on forest ecosystem of timber, then what was the Qing Empire's impact on the world of timber?
Well, that's a great question. And I've been thinking a lot about the very long-term political ecology of an agrarian empire, like Imperial China. And I'm not just talking about the late Imperial period, but Imperial China for 2,000 years, right? So occasionally, we know that they did have some very intensive state-directed project, right? That directly influenced the transformation of landscapes, and sometimes those would have very long-lasting impacts, such as, you know, if you build a great wall, or if you dig up the Great Canal, right? And those tend to be the kind of activities that stand out in historical records, and therefore we pay a lot of attention to those kind of activities, especially in the case of Chinese history, where the historical materials tend to have a state-centered bias, right? So however, as I show in this book, if we do compare the state's consumption of timber, right, for some massive construction projects, if we compare them with the mass consumption over an extended period of time, not just in those years or in that particular decade when the state did build something, but over the period of a century or more than several centuries, then the state didn't seem to be the dominant driver of timber demand. When we compare that to how much the market is consuming, right? Moreover, late imperial China, so basically from the 14th century onward, it did not have a system of state-directed forest management either, right? The reason that some areas of China in this period developed regenerative forestry had nothing to do with any state-led initiatives of forest conservation at all. So in that sense, as I put it in the book, the state's impact seemed not to be great, right? Seemed minimal. Yet still, right, despite the state's lack of direct concern with forests, I do think that if we are thinking about the time horizon of centuries and even millennia, political organizations did play a central role in the transformation of Chinese landscapes. That transformation included the disappearance of natural forests and the appearance of timber plantations managed by people. And this influence was not through the state's strong directions and regulations, but through the very weak incentives it provided consistently for a very long time, right? So by that, I mean, they, for example, by maintaining peace in broader areas for centuries at a time by expanding the imperial administrative structure over larger territories and by recognizing and upholding private property norms and other things that would sound very rudimentary and not directly relevant to forestry. By doing these things, I think the state played a very pivotal role in the transformation of China's landscapes. So we have to keep in mind that pre-modern states were very weak in today's terms. But the accumulated effects of their continued existence itself enabled other more direct drivers, such as population growth and agriculture expansion and market development, to transform the landscape in irreversible ways.
I see. I think what you are saying is when we talk about or think about the Qing state's impact on the world of timber, maybe it's too narrow if we just interpret this impact as the state's direct consumption of timber itself. But there are other related or even tangentially related other things that were actually impacting the either the consumption or production or the market or the ecosystem of this particular tree or item. And I think that's kind of naturally leading to the second, the central chapter of your book that dealt with this very extraordinary phenomenon, speaking to or reflecting kind of the people at the time or the society at the time come up or derived to this particular way to sustain or maintain timber supply. And you mentioned this very complex system of shareholding practices to sustain the timber supply. So what do you think is the core, is the one core feature of such a successful system?
Mm-hmm. Right. So by the 18th century, if not earlier, right, a huge volume of timber was cut not from natural forests, but from plantations. And by plantations, I'm talking about, you know, the planting of timber by small holders, right? Not the kind of huge capitalist slave-holding cotton plantations of the American South, right? It's not the same kind of model. So in this smallholder regenerative forestry, the return from planting the trees is very delayed, right? Because it you have to wait for at least 20, most likely 30 to 40 years before the trees could be harvested. So that requires very patient investment. Then the question is, how did the people at the time pull that off, right? In economic terms, it's a problem of financing long-term investment under liquidity constraints. So even with our modern financial system nowadays, we know that it continues to be a big problem in the state-sponsored, household-managed reforestation projects in China today. So you can imagine that difficulty was much more daunting in early modern times. So then it turns out that they actually developed a very sophisticated shareholding system based on expected, not realized, expected future revenues. And I think that is the key feature of this successful system. So the way in which private forestry was organized, it was, it seemed mundane, but at the same time, ingenious at the same time. So for any scholar who knows something about late imperial Chinese land tenure, I think it wouldn't be surprising to say that the same kind of contractual formats for rice paddies were also used for timberlands. But out of these familiar contractual terms, they created abstract shares out of it, right? So the claims on the future revenue from the trees could change hands as liquid financial instruments so that the landowners and the planters, they don't have to wait for a very long time for the trees to grow up, right? That means they could sell off their shares to potential investors with capital years before the trees were harvested, right? So this shareholding practice in forestry is very similar to the proportional liability shareholding structure that were widely used in Chinese business partnerships. And I would even say that this practice in forestry anticipated the wide adoption of such a liability structure in the business partnerships. And if these financial practices sound very savvy for traditional forestry, we also have to keep in mind that these were not only found in China's economic core areas, but also in the ethnically diverse, economically less affluent frontier region of Southwest China as well. So I think this holds some very serious implications for how we think about effective forestry and also the history of finance and business in a globally comparative network.
That's, I think, is indeed ingenious and also very eye-opening when reading that chapter, that almost it felt surreal. Maybe I'm too ignorant that at that time people were coming up with this very sophisticated, and you said lasting over decades of years to maintain the trade and maintain the tree growth. And
yeah, it's very smart. It's way beyond what I imagined before I get into the sources.
Yeah, so in addition to what happened or teasing out for us what happened, I was wondering whether you could share a little bit more how people at the time were talking about or writing about what they were doing. So in order to do away the anachronistic fallacy, so how was this concept of sustainability that we are quite familiar nowadays, and how was this concept being talked about in the sources that you were dealing with?
Mm-hmm. Right. So first I want to say a few words to clarify what I mean by sustainable or sustainability in this book, right? Because these terms have become loaded with divergent meanings and different political inclinations as well. I think oftentimes we think of the issue of sustainability as in sort of black and white terms as an either or question, but really it is a gradation of degrees, right? And also sustainability has multiple dimensions because, for example, we hope a sustainable pace of resource use is also socially sustainable in that it does not involve the systematic deprivation of any particular social group. And from a pragmatic perspective, if the kind of environmental measures that we come up today can prove to be sustainable both environmentally and socially for, say, a couple of centuries, I would say we are very lucky and able to claim that we can be sustainable eternally is just too lofty and arrogant, I would say. So the practices of regenerative forestry in late imperial southern China, I think it can be called sustainable in the following sense. For centuries, they were able to regenerate timber at a pace that satisfied market and state demands and substituted for natural growths. And socially, the multiple players along the supply chain, from the tenant planters at the bottom of the system to timber owners to lumberjacks to rafters and brokers and merchants and bankers and so forth. So all of these players, despite their many conflicts and negotiations, ultimately they all had a stake in ensuring that the next rounds of trees were planted in time, right? So the system is sustainable in that sense. And we certainly that is already a quite remarkable achievement, but still we don't want to exaggerate the level of sustainability that they achieved. Now, to your question about how the sources discussed this issue, I think my understanding is that the individual planters and the landowners didn't really care about sustainability, right? They made their choices of crops, right? What kind of crops to grow to better their own livelihood and to increase their own income. It just turned out that in some areas, during some period, the best crop for that purpose turned out to be timber trees, right? It's the same economic and livelihood calculations as, say, the rice cultivators in the lowland or the potato growers on the hillside. So in the Chinese historiography, we are sort of familiar with the story of how many rice paddy, mulberry tree, and fish pond complexes in southern China managed to be sustainably productive for many, many centuries, right? And they are upheld as examples of sustainability in some works. We're also familiar with the story of how the so-called quote-unquote shed people who grew maize and New World crops on the hillside then brought big problems of deforestation and erosion in the early modern period. But I think it would be wrong to say that the rice growers were more sustainability minded than the shed people, because they are, I think their calculation is the same. And the same logic applies to the tree growers, right? They were exploiting an economic opportunity generated by the expanding timber demand. And the kind of institutions that they used to do that happened to be aligned with some of the objectives that we nowadays associated with sustainability, although not all of them, but some of them. So I think the lesson that we want to draw from this historical case is that if our grand policy objectives can be realized through local level institutions that align with the local people's livelihood interests, right? Then that works less costly and more sustainably than top-down technocratic directives.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I see. I think it's just actual historical actors at the time were probably driven by simple interest. Right, but it for a scholar or for an author that working on this subject, it's just amazing to see that different factors or different players in this trade or in this consumption or building or planting the trees that somehow miraculously realized all kinds of goals for different parties. And as we're talking about, and as you already mentioned, touched upon a few times in the questions or answers you provided before, there are multiple institutions, quite unique, that enabled the success of this timber trade and timber ecosystem at this time period. So through chapter 4 and 5, you're focusing on different kinds of institutions specifically, if I summarize that correctly. And particularly, you talked about the timber trade usually lasted years long and crossed long distances. And specifically, you collected 255 timber trade debt cases. So out of curiosity and for those legal cases, I was wondering, what was the most frequently cited or frequent occurred challenge mentioned in those legal cases, and how was that challenge usually resolved?
Mm-hmm. Right. So these two chapters just look at the timber market more closely. And I find that the timber market was a very decentralized space. And it continued to be the case until the early decades of the 20th century, although by that time, changes were already underway. So this whole trading system was dependent on short-term credit, right? So the short-term credit was like the central pump of this huge circulatory system. In that situation, the risk of default could be devastating, not only to the merchants who could not get their money back, but also this crisis could fit into the upstream players, right? To the planters and influencing their decisions whether to plant trees for the next round. So that's why I turned to look at the cases of default. And default is not just the failure to pay. It could take many different forms. It could be, you know, the attempt to extending your grace period over and over again. It could be that people already entered into a contract and then the market prices moved and one party tried to take advantage of that price movement and just revoke that earlier contract. So all of these forms of contract violations, right, I put it under the sort of umbrella rubric of default. And to look at how people deal with these challenges, especially without a very interventionist court system, I turn to look at the sort of the informational and the financial functions of intermediaries and how private order enforcement within merchant organizations interacted with the court system. And I find that really in contrary to our stereotypical impressions of the so-called licensed brokers, so in Chinese, the yahang, and the merchant organizations, so in Chinese, this would be the huiguan or the gongsuo. So these institutions could hardly claim any monopolistic fiefdom, although they try to do so. But there is no sort of insured protection of their monopolistic claims, right? In the end, outside groups could very effectively get into this field and challenge any dominant players and make the whole play field very competitive. That is especially for the larger market, for the redistribution centers of timber, such as Hankou and Nanjing for this period. The role that these intermediaries and merchant organizations played was more based on information. So as centrally positioned nodes in a network, they channeled information, enforced contracts, they tried to mediate disputes among merchants that came from all different kind of places. Sometimes, often they could do that autonomously, but other times in collaboration with state authorities. So in these two chapters, I try to tease out how these different intermediating agents interacted with both the merchant groups and with the state.
Thank you so much. I think as our audience, you can hear from our brief conversation so far in these different chapters or different angles. Dr. Meng Zhang in his book really try to find different angles, different perspectives through various cases to present how timber and forestry was managed as a resource, as a trade, and also as a, or not as, but actually achieved sustainable development. It is really a rich and eye-opening book. And as you already achieved such a wonderful combination or production of scholarship, our last question, the time goes by so fast. Our last question today is, could you share with us what you are working on right now? What is your next exciting project?
I'm actually working on two very different projects. It might be too ambitious, but I like sort of exploring unfamiliar territories, and we'll see how that goes. So one project carries on my interest in the interactions between human institutions and the environment. And I try to move beyond China proper into the maritime world. So in this project, I follow the social life of edible bird's nests. So this is made from the hardened saliva of a particular species, a very rare species of cave nesting swiftlets. And the project look at the period from the 16th century to the 19th century. During that time, this exotica from Southeast Asia transformed into a luxurious delicacy and a medical elixir. Highly pursued by the elite Chinese consumers, both within China and also in the Chinese diaspora overseas. And they spurred a trade network that connected, again, multiple players is what I'm interested in, right? So in the South China Sea, including Chinese merchants, of course, but also the European East Indian companies and the traders from the island. And it brought transformations to the life and the environment of both humans and the swiftlets in this case. So that's one. And another direction of my research examines the spread of foreign debt in non-Western regions as an instrument of public finance in the late 19th through early 20th century. So in this regard, I think, you know, past research has mostly focused on the adoption and the adaption of Western economic concepts and practices in China under the framework of the so-called self-strengthening or the Westernization reforms. But my interest in this is not so much how China learned from the West, but how the experiences of other quote-unquote Oriental societies, right? Say the Ottoman Empire, Egypt, the African colonies, and so forth. So how the experiences of these other non-Western societies with Western-style public debt were filtered into the Chinese world of knowledge at this crucial period, late 19th, early 20th century, and how these filtered knowledge informed the intellectual currents and policymaking, and they also sort of contributed to uphold a view of the world political economy that conforms to the hierarchic capitalist order of international finance. So this, as you can see, the two projects are very different, but I think they're both related to some aspects of this first book, right? There's an environmental and material culture angle. There's also this credit and the construction of debt relationships angle. But in this case, I'm looking less at the credit relation between individual merchants, but between sovereign states.
This is so exciting. And as you were saying, these are, even though these are two seemingly quite different, they are. they are very different projects, but indeed they did follow the combined interest of kind of economic history plus whether environmental history or kind of state politics interactions. And I'm really excited that one is taking on or bringing animal as an actor or the field of gastronomy, and the other one is more specifically or more explicitly world comparative historical method. And it's really exciting to think about same or similar questions that you raised here in this timber and forestry question book, but continue to explore in different contexts in the upcoming two books. And I really hope we could read them not so long.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think thank you again, Dr. Meng Zhang, for coming here and sharing with us. And to our listeners, today we have Dr. Meng Zhang with her new book, Timber and Forestry in Qing China, Sustaining the Market, that came out 2021 with University of Washington Press. And I really encourage you to read the book to learn more, not just about the tree itself, but the all the exciting and maybe same questions you have known, but with the different answers you might be expecting from this book. And that is all for today. Thank you very much for listening. See you in our next episode.